A judge today starts hearing a case mixing politics, media, and telecommunications. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. AT&T's proposed $85 billion takeover of Time Warner goes before a federal judge today. The Trump Justice Department is suing to block this on antitrust grounds. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
AT&T is primarily a wireless phone, internet, and satellite TV provider. Time Warner mostly provides media content with a marquee lineup including HBO, CNN, and March Madness. Vertically integrating distribution and content makes sense, according to analyst Tuna Amobi at CFRA Research. He says, if you're AT&T looking over your shoulder at internet competitors like Amazon, Google, and Netflix, all trying to reach your customers directly with streaming video, social media, and who knows what's coming next.
The bigger you are, the more leverage that you can exert, the more that you're also able to adapt to this new world order of direct-to-consumer offerings.
But that massive reach up and down the media supply chain could leave AT&T with too much market power, says University of Michigan business professor Eric Gordon.
They could give preference to content that comes from Time Warner,
giving AT&T an unfair advantage over its competitors, he says. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Markets this morning seem to be on a downward slope. Dow and S&P futures are down 0.5%. The NASDAQ future down 1.4%. The FTSE in London down 1.4%. Washington has been a fire hose of uncertainty in recent days. And this week is Jerome Powell's first policy meeting as head of the Fed. The benchmark interest rate is up at 2.87% now. Now, we have a strand of coverage this year called Divided Decade. It's been 10 years since risky lending coupled with exotic financial engineering plus greed combined to wreck the world financial system. My Marketplace colleague Kai Rizdahl just had an extended conversation with three top people who fought that fire. Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary under President Bush, Ben Bernanke, the powerful head of the Federal Reserve, and Timothy Geithner, head of the New York Fed. Was the government right to rescue big banks in a world where so many people have no safety net? Listen to this piece of tape from that conversation. It evokes the expansive, reflective mood of that conversation. It's Geithner, the New York Fed president, who would later become Treasury Secretary.
This is the central dilemma for policymakers in a crisis, which is that everybody's instinct is to let the thing burn.
Yeah.
Because it seems just to let it burn, and it seems fair, good for future incentives, good for moral hazard, better at preventing future crises. But if you let the thing burn to the point the system collapses, you're going to be left with hundreds of millions of innocent victims. And it is very hard for people to understand, completely understandably, that what feels unjust and immoral in the context of breaking a panic is the most just thing to do if your interest is trying to prevent the economy from mass unemployment or a decade of bread lines across the country like what happened in the Great Depression. And it's a hard thing for people to appreciate, I think, in part because, you know, we hadn't had a major financial panic in 75 years. There was no living memory of what the risks were in letting a panic burn go too far. And that's in some ways, it's the central reason why these things are so terrible, because the natural human political instinct around fairness and justice collides with what is necessary and effective to protect the most people.
Former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. It's the first time Geithner, Paulson, and Bernanke have spoken together in public since the crisis. The Marketplace PM program will have extended parts of that conversation later today. The financial crisis changed our lives and changed the culture. Divided Decade is our year-long reporting project. If you own a house, you probably can recite your property tax number by rote. But how about your city or county fees? What's my sewer fee? I don't know, 70, 76 a year? Marketplace's Ryan Kailoth looked into this, and these fees are rising around the country.
Something you should know about the people of Scranton, Pennsylvania. They don't love corny jokes about the TV show The Office.
I'm sorry, man. I couldn't help myself.
That's all right.
But Adam Jafrida of Dynamico Corporation hates something else even more.
You know, it started with the rental registration fees.
Jafrida's a landlord in Scranton, 160 apartments. And a few years ago, the city more than tripled its fee for registering a rental unit.
And I said, listen, I don't feel this is fair. You guys are going to have to sit down and work with me on this, or I'm going to hire a lawyer.
Jafrida won a class action suit for excessive rental fees. And now he's got another lawsuit challenging the city's trash pickup fee, which recently increased 69%.
You have a city contractor license fee, a building permit fee, an appeals board fee. You have a dog license fee.
That last one also tripled from $15 to $45.
Do you have a dog?
I have a cat, but I'm hiding them because I don't know if I can afford the tags for them. I'm sure I'll be receiving a letter tomorrow after this goes on the air.
Scranton city officials didn't respond to my many calls, but the city is not alone in this.
Across the country, many cities are turning to fees and charges as a way of raising revenues.
Andrew Rashovsky with the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy has been studying this across 150 major cities. He says it varies place to place, but the trend is
user charge revenues are growing. And given that other sources of city revenue have been declining, they become a larger share of total city budgets.
Rashovsky says cities started turning to fees and service charges after the recession wiped out property tax revenue. A lot of cities tried raising tax rates instead, but state governments tend to cap those. And when cities have high pension obligations or other costs, they have to raise money somehow. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
And 123 miles east of Scranton, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.